Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. Coming up on the programme tonight, the banking inquiry.
We now have evidence on every street you walk down and every door you knock on of the catastrophic consequences of the light touch regulation introduced by Fianna Fáil over the years.
The banking inquiry, a truth finder or a political witch hunt? It's our late debate tonight after the news, which is read now by Eileen Whelan.
Good evening. A number of local authorities have warned Irish Water that it may not be paying them enough to maintain existing services such as producing drinking water and fixing leaks. The company has signed contracts or service level agreements with all 34 local authorities. Documents obtained by RTE News show serious concerns in these agreements over resources. In one instance, Dublin City Council said that Irish Water had not yet confirmed that an adequate budget would be provided. The council also said that due to budget cutbacks, it faced staff shortages in several areas, including water treatment and wastewater collection and treatment. The Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, has said a state-backed insurance scheme for mortgage deposits should be ready for inclusion in this autumn's finance bill. The government has been looking at using mortgage deposit insurance as a way to kick-start house building, particularly in Dublin. The insurance would also allow the banks to reduce the size of deposit required from borrowers. Mr. Noonan said the scheme would be restricted to first-time buyers of new homes. Government officials in Turkey say 17 miners have died after an explosion and fire at a coal mine. The blast happened near the town of Soma, northeast of the city of Izmir. More than 200 people are thought to be trapped underground. Oxygen is being pumped into the shafts. Officials say the explosion was caused by an electrical fault. The Minister for Transport, Leo Varadkar, has called on the Impact Trade Union and Aer Lingus to make full use of the state's industrial relation bodies to avoid a strike planned for the end of the month. Impact has served notice on the company of a 24-hour stoppage by cabin crew at Dublin, Cork and Shannon airports on Friday, the 30th of May. The union said it was taking the action in a row over rostering and claimed the company had failed to engage on the issue over several years. Aer Lingus has said the threatened strike is unwarranted and it will continue discussion with Impact on the rostering issue. The weather forecast, showers dying out tonight with clear spells at first, but patches of rain, drizzle and fog will develop in western and northwestern areas. Lowest temperatures 4 to 8 degrees. Mild and close tomorrow with patches of drizzle, mist and fog, mainly over the north and west. Dry and bright spells will develop too, with highest temperatures 14 to 18 degrees. And that's all for now. News again on Radio 1 at 11, but now back to the late debate.
Eileen, thank you very much indeed. With me on the programme tonight to debate the forthcoming banking inquiry are Owen Murphy, Fine Gael TD and a member of the Inquiries Committee, Michael McGrath, Fianna Fáil's finance spokesman, who's also been nominated to the Inquiries Committee, financial analyst Cormac Lucy, who hasn't, neither has David Duffy, who's an expert in corporate governance, and he's the author of the book The Management of Management, A Practical Guide to Corporate Governance. Well, the committee will be chaired by Labour TD Kieran Lynch, and as well as Owen and Michael, its members will also include Kieran O'Donnell and John Paul Phelan, both of Fine Gael, Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty and independent TD Stephen Donnelly. And it also looks like there'll be two senators on board. The names being mentioned at the moment are Professor Sean Barrett and either Labour's Aideen Hayden or Susan O'Keefe. And Owen, when will the final makeup be finalised?
Well, we'll have the motion for the seven TDs will go to the Dáil tomorrow, and then I think the Senate will have their own motion either tomorrow evening or on Thursday. They have a slightly different process. They'll have to nominate the that the proposal go to a selection committee, and then that selection committee will pick the two senators. I think it'll be one Labour senator and one independent senator. But we should have the full committee membership by the end of the week.
OK. And Michael McGrath, if that does turn out to be the case, you're the only Fianna Fáil member on it. There's a clear government majority on the committee.
Yeah, there is a clear government majority on the committee. I suppose it was always going to be that way, given the makeup of the Oireachtas. I mean, to put our cards on the table from the very outset, we expressed the view that it would be far better if this inquiry was conducted outside of politics, that politicians were not conducting the inquiry. But that horse has bolted. The decision has been made. It is going to be an Oireachtas inquiry. So we are going to fully participate. And if I am going to be the only representative from Fianna Fáil, then, you know, I will certainly participate in a full manner. We'll ask questions without fear or favour of anybody, and we'll adopt the view that we should really be following the evidence to see where it leads us, to see what conclusions can be reached.
David Duffy, do you think this inquiry is necessary?
Well, I think the big challenge will be, if it does proceed, what the outcome's going to be. We've had four already. mostly carried out by academics and senior public servants. The challenge for the committee or the inquiry this time is actually to start with the end in sight in terms of what outcome they're seeking. So that, I assume, will be part of the deliberations in trying to scope the inquiry and in the context, I suppose, of what the other inquiry said about what they tried to achieve and if they didn't achieve anything, if at all.
Cormac Lucy, what's your view on the necessity or otherwise of this inquiry when we've already had four?
I'm not sure we're going to learn an awful lot more. We may get some political titillation from seeing certain people sweat as they're asked hard questions. But I'm not sure, you know, given the four reports we've had from Regling, Honohan, Wright and Nyberg, I'm not sure we learn anything fundamental. And I think there are other areas where the Oireachtas could more usefully devote time. For example, why are we so slow in fixing the mortgage crisis? We're 6 years into this crisis since the guarantee in 08. Or what about an examination of what Eamon Gilmore suggested at the last election, that it's Labour's way or Frankfurt's way, that Ireland has a binary choice? And what about teasing out the implications of that choice? Eamon Gilmore seemed to think it was a real choice in the run-up to the last election. Many people clearly voted for him on that basis. But it was shut down by a government decision behind closed doors. But wouldn't it be interesting to find out what were the thought processes behind that decision?
And in relation to your suggestion about the mortgage crisis, is it your view that that's a real practical thing that could be done now going into the future rather than having an inquiry into something that has already happened 6 years ago and there have been already a number of reports into it?
Correct. I think what is proposed is just going to go on the battlefield and poke its way around a few corpses and maybe come up with a new body count, whereas we're fighting real battles on the mortgage front and we're making very heavy weather of making any progress on it, and we need to really pull the finger out. And if Mr. Clinton said in November 2011 that this was the major problem facing Ireland, that's 2.5 years ago, and we've made pitiful progress on the problem since then.
Is that a fair point, Owen?
No, I think what we need to bear in mind is that we want to prevent future crises as well. And, you know, we look at the past reports that have been done into the crisis. There are gaps in our knowledge and those gaps need to be completed. But also it's important for people who are involved at the time in different positions in Irish life to answer questions publicly. I think that's an important thing that should happen. And then we want to learn from the crisis and see how different institutions might need to change. I mean, you see, for example, in the Wright report, the many recommendations that were made for the restructuring of the Department of Finance, many have been implemented under John Moran, and that's a good thing. But there are still other areas that we need to look at in terms of Oireachtas oversight, government oversight, the role of the cabinet, sequencing of events. Those questions do need to be answered, and I think it's important that they are, if we are to prevent a future mortgage crisis or a future banking crisis or the need to set up something like NAMA or to recapitalise banks in the future. So that, I think, is the importance of this inquiry.
What exactly will you be investigating? Is it the events leading up to the night of the guarantee? Will it include the night of the guarantee? Will it include anything after that night?
Well, how the committee actually conducts its work will be decided by the members when we're set up in terms of putting together our terms of reference and then a phasing for the inquiry. If we go back to the Public Accounts Committee in 2012, we did a scoping report as to how this might look. Very lengthy document, about 300 pages with over 200 questions we felt needed to be answered. But in that, we talked about a three-pillar inquiry. One would look at the guarantee itself, so the immediate run-up to it and then the subsequent events after the night. The second phase might look then at the role of the banks and then their auditors as well. And the third phase might then look at the role of government institutions. So that report, I think, will come before the new committee. I mean, I don't want to preface anything because I'm not sure exactly how the chair will decide to proceed, but I'd imagine that would be a starting point, which we then decide what modules to have and then how to phase those modules and then who would be the key witnesses and the questions that we would ask, and then we'd proceed from there. But again, it will fall to the committee and the individual members as on that committee to decide that.
Would you support that structure, Michael?
Well, much of the commentary from various government ministers on this issue so far of the inquiry has focused very much on the bank guarantee. Now, in my view, that has to form a very important part of the inquiry. But let's bear in mind that that was the response to the crisis. That was the manner in which it was handled and dealt with. Equally important is to to identify precisely the factors that led to the crisis in the first place, the decisions that were being made within the banks in which these losses were being built up in the first place, the role of the credit committees, for example, the governance structures within those institutions, and why there was such a dependency on lending to one particular sector. So I think, you know, there's a great temptation here for the government side to use this inquiry really for maximum political advantage for Fine Gael and Labour coming up to the next election. And I think if that were to be the case, then it would be a missed opportunity. We absolutely have to examine how the crisis was managed and what the policy response was. But it is just as important to examine what led to the crisis in the first place and the role that each individual played in that. And I think, Audrey, we should be very honest with people at the outset of this inquiry. You know, this inquiry is no substitute for criminal proceedings. It isn't going to meet the public appetite for people to be punished, for bankers to be sent to jail. Nobody will go to jail as a result of this inquiry. Nobody will lose their job. Nobody will have their pension reduced. This really is an inquiry, record, report inquiry, almost certainly, which will, I suppose, provide maybe a fuller explanation and will provide a human explanation, because the faces involved will have to come before the committee in a public forum, answer questions, and hopefully, you know, provide the answers that people want to have provided. But I think it's important to set, you know, manage those expectations about what this inquiry is all about. It will report, I suppose, a narrative exactly of what happened, and it will be certainly more colourful than the reports we've had so far, because the individuals will be directly there giving evidence, and their commentary will form part of the report. But nobody will go to jail, and nobody will lose their pension, and nobody will lose their job. We should be very honest with people at the outset.
Owen Murphy.
Yeah, I think Michael's absolutely correct when he talks about expectations and the role of an Oireachtas inquiry as distinct from a criminal inquiry, what that might lead to. But, you know, I don't think we should infer that because there's a majority of government TDs that this will be run by the government.
Well, it has been so far.
Well, it hasn't been, because the committee hasn't been set up yet.
The minister went on public radio announcing who the chairperson was going to be, announced what the membership of the committee would be. The Taoiseach has already reached his own conclusions as to what led to the whole crisis, has already attributed political blame. But that isn't the right footing on which to start off on, and that's my point.
But Michael, like, that's up to us how we start it off, because we'll be the members of the committee, we'll decide the terms of reference, and we'll ask the questions, and we'll do the investigation.
Okay, let me play a clip of Enda Kenny from last week, just hours really after the inquiry was announced. Here's him and Pierce Doherty from last week.
We need to know the truth. And we now have evidence on every street you walk down, on every door you knock on, on every place, both town and village and parish around the country, of the catastrophic consequences of the light touch regulation introduced by Fianna Fáil over the years.
I think it's regretful that the government didn't consult with opposition parties, have kept us in the dark and announced this through the media, told us that they would consult with us at a later stage. And when we've tried to have those consultations arranged, their offices know nothing of it. So I think that's deeply regrettable.
It's deeply political from the outset, Owen.
Well, no, the government did consult with the other parties, and I understand that Sinn Féin didn't accept actually an opportunity to be briefed by the Oireachtas team as to how this inquiry might unfold. I mean, I think it's important to recognise that the members of the committee will be running this investigation and no one else. And just like we do in the Public Accounts Committee, and I'm a member of that committee, we leave our party hat at the door. I mean, this inquiry is too important for it to be politicised. And of course, the Taoiseach is free to make political statements in the Dáil and to have an opinion. He must. He's the leader of the main political party in the government. But when Michael and I go into that committee, along with the other members, we have to leave all those considerations aside and work in the best interests of both a robust banking inquiry, but also the Oireachtas itself. Because what we don't want is something like an Abhi Lara happening again in terms of that investigation, or something that would show the Oireachtas not be capable of handling these big investigations.
Even though it's a government chair, there's a government majority, it was announced just before the local elections, it may complete just before a general election is scheduled for 2016. How can it be anything other than a show trial championed by Fine Gael and Labour?
Well, again, that comes back to the members of the committee. I mean, the timing, I think, relates more to what happened with the Anglo trial than anything else, and also the fact that we've had to prepare legislation so the committee have sufficient powers, get the orders brought in. But again, I mean, it goes back to the members and how they will conduct themselves. I mean, if we were to go off and be nakedly political with this, we could end up, you know, ruining the whole committee and all its work, and that would be very damaging to politics and very damaging to our parties and would be damaging to me as an individual. And again, I think when you look at the membership of the committee, and Kieran O'Donnell and myself both serving on the Public Accounts Committee, we serve on that committee without the party whip. And we've often done things that the government have not been happy with. But that's what we do, because that's our duty, is to investigate public spending and to hold the government of the day to account.
Do you still believe, like your party leader and the Taoiseach believed last year, I think it was, he said, maybe a little bit longer ago than that, that there was an axis of collusion between Fianna Fáil and the banks?
It wouldn't be appropriate for me to make any kind of comments in relation to that at this point. I mean, we're going to form the committee tomorrow. There's going to be issues of presumed bias, prejudice. These kinds of issues have to be dealt with by the committee in terms of its terms of reference and looking for power to proceed from the Committee of Procedures and Privileges. So, I mean, again, you know, those things I can't comment on possibly, because it would put me in a difficult position to actually then serve on that committee to, I suppose, prejudge the outcome myself as a member of the inquiry team.
Michael, what do you say to all of that? That it's down to the committee's membership. You will go in and you'll leave your party affiliations at the door. Everyone will.
Well, I very much accept Owen's bona fides, and I believe what he is saying as regards his own approach as an individual deputy. And I hope that that is going to be replicated by everybody else, because I will certainly be adopting that approach. I'm not going into this inquiry with the mindset of protecting anyone or trying to put a certain political narrative on the events that led up to the crisis and the management of the crisis by the then government. My view is that it is fundamentally important that this inquiry works, because the parliamentary system essentially is on trial here. And if this process is abused in a partisan party political way, then we will be seen to have failed. And public confidence in politics, which is at an all-time low, will be further damaged. So I think a lot really will flow from the terms of reference, Audrey. You know, if the evidence is that the committee is singularly focused on one government decision, then that would tell me that this is very much a political inquiry. But if we are genuinely to look at, you know, the role of the banks themselves, the role of the financial regulator, the role of the ECB, for example, in not allowing the previous and current government to impose losses on senior bondholders, if we're to look at the role of the external auditors, for example, the professional advisors who advised the government and the agencies at the time when the crisis really was in the eye of a storm, then if we do all of that properly, then I think we can get a proper rounded assessment of what happened at that time, and not a party political show trial, because Owen is right, that would actually blow up in their faces if they tried to do that.
Cormac, do you think this can be anything but politicised?
No, in a word, because even if you don't have a party political complexion on this, you'll have individual members on the committee who will hope to raise their own personal profile by performing well in this committee, and they can best do that by being a lightning rod for public anger rather than by offering calm reflection. And there are some points of calm reflection which would be helpful on the committee. For example, Owen suggested that the report or the committee should try and find out how can we eliminate the danger of the sort of crisis we're now in from ever recurring. We really can't. There's no evidence across the developed free market world that you can stop bubbles from occurring. And there's been a series of rolling financial bubbles across the Western world going back to the South Sea bubble in the 1600s or 1700s. Another question is this suggestion of collusion between Fianna Fáil and the banks, which overlooks entirely the point that the Maastricht Treaty forbids governments from even seeking to influence central banks and financial regulators. So for me, a key question that I'm not hearing being raised in the run-up to this is, where was the central bank in all of this? They had institutional freedom to do unpopular things. They gave warnings of a bubbly house market in Dublin in 1999 and 1998. And then, fearful of losing authority for having cried wolf and no wolf having seemed to appear, they went quiet. So that in 07, they gave a wholly reassuring view of the prospects of the Irish market at a time when house prices were far, far higher than when they had earlier issued warnings. And I think what we're seeing is elected public officials who were in office and who are known to the public are being dragged into a sort of a dock, while unelected public officials who actually had the freedom to do something about it and didn't can slither away because, oh, they're... that they are not known to the public.
Do you agree, David?
They will have to be brought in as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, presumably they'll be called before the committee.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm sure they will.
David?
Yes, I do. One thing I think is probably worth saying, which I think Owen alluded to, is that, you know, one of the benefits of this, it could be therapeutic for the country, bit like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, where people will get a chance, as Michael has said, to see people probably squirming in the dock, being very uncomfortable. That could be helpful, just to see that whoever they think is wrong or right, being made quite uncomfortable. One of my big concerns about this, and it's been talked about, if we were to start with a committee of inquiry or a bank inquiry, I wouldn't start from where we are today. Mm. I would not have, and with all due respect to my colleagues here, politicians investigating politicians. I think it should have been totally independent from people outside the country with the appropriate skills and competencies. And I think that's a real
risk. Has that not already happened through the other reports?
It has, but you would have to ask yourself, has anything actually happened as a result of those four reports? You know, there's no doubt that the central bank has beefed up its skills. It brought in Matthew Elderfield. It's got Cyril in there now. But despite the fact that, you know, regulation probably has got quite tough and the banking and insurance sector would say it's gone too far, we still have, you know, a big $250 million hold in RSA, you know, last year.
The insurance company.
Yes. Exactly. So, you know, maybe that was a one-off. I don't know. But it doesn't do any good for our regulatory regime.
Rowan Murphy.
You know, just to come back to what Cormac was saying, I mean, you can't stop economic cycles, but we can certainly learn from mistakes we made in the past and try and manage risks better. And I think the concern you raise about individual politicians potentially using this committee to up their own profile and grandstand to the media and seem very impressive and even try to maybe kind of vent public anger, or public opinion, the legal remit in which we'll operate will be so tightly defined that we won't be able to do that, I don't think. I mean, I think that's going to be a safeguard on members themselves. We we looked at the legalities around this in detail previously on the PAC, and in the model that Michael was referring to, which is probably the model we'll adopt, an inquire, record and report, we won't be able to make findings against individuals. But not even that, we won't be able to infer findings in our questioning. So that will be an important aspect of it. And I think that, you know, again, we're talking about the timelines for setting this up, the preparatory phase, when we sit down as a committee behind closed doors and prepare for each module and phase, will be about what questions we can and cannot ask, how we would ask them, who would ask them. All those issues will be sorted out in that phase, or that space, I suppose, before the phases begin, exactly to stop that kind of thing that you're worried about happening. Because, I mean, we've seen a bit of it on the Public Accounts Committee as well. And I think it's a natural fear to have. You know, you talk about, in inverted commas, dragging politicians in, and then other politicians are there to, you know, perceivingly give them a kicking. That's not what we need to happen here. So what we're looking to do, and again, it's going to be a huge amount of work, is a very professional inquiry. And with very strict parameters from a legal point of view, but also in terms of the terms of reference. I mean, that has to be, it has to be a very strict terms of reference if it's to function.
Okay. Mike,
yeah, one key concern I do have, Audrey, is that arising from the Abby Lara judgment, as you know, this inquiry will not be able to make any adverse findings to the reputation of any individual. But people coming before the inquiry as witnesses will feel that their reputation is on the line through the court of public opinion, because this will play out on the airwaves. It will be in public session, for example. The legislation underpinning this inquiry provides they can bring their lawyers with them. And, you know, I do have a major concern that all of this could get bogged down in legal wrangling, that people will head to the four courts as soon as they receive the invitation or the summons from this committee to appear before it, because they will know that, in effect, their reputation is on the line, even though it may not be in black and white in the conclusions of this report, that, in effect, that is what is at stake. And I think the best that we can hope from this inquiry is that we will, for once and for all, and I think we owe it to future generations, to encapsulate all of the facts surrounding what happened, the build-up to the crisis, the management of the crisis, the role of all the major stakeholders involved, and that those directly involved are held accountable in a public forum. That really is the best that we can hope to achieve.
But isn't there a very strong likelihood, as we have seen through the Anglo trial, that the major response perhaps from many of the people to appear before the committee will be, I can't remember, I don't know?
Yeah, that is distinctly possible. And some of the evidence given to the Anglo trial was absolutely extraordinary. And you know, I'm sure many of those people, including from the Financial Regulator's Office, will, of course, be invited before the inquiry in due course. And that may well happen. But, you know, we can only enter into this process in good faith. You know, there is certainly concern that legalities will play a central role in the evolution of this inquiry. And I think if it does, then we could get bogged down in the mire of that. And, you know, I think it's important in laying out the terms of reference, there may well be a modular approach adopted, there may well be interim reports, but I think that legally it will be very important that the work of this inquiry team is concluded by the current Oireachtas. Otherwise, if you have some members of the Oireachtas not re-elected, for example, mm-hmm. a new inquiry team being constituted after the next election, then I think the whole thing could fall into serious legal question. So there are a lot of issues at stake here which will require very careful management, and you know, those would be some of the concerns and some of the flags that we would raise at this stage, and it's important that we nail them down as tightly as we can.
Cormac, how do they get around that, where there seems to be very little recorded evidence, particularly from the night of the guarantee itself?
Well, I think after the night of the guarantee, it should be pretty clear. It should be possible to do a reconstruction. A number of weeks ago, the Irish Times published notes, accounts that had been made immediately following that night. And one thing that was quite notable was every account that they published was a private sector account. There were no accounts or notes made subsequent to the meeting, or apparently made by any of the central bankers or regulators or ministers or civil servants present. Now, maybe that is a defensive response to Freedom of Information Act. Maybe that is a complete lack of professionalism. Maybe they've been reading up Cardinal Richelieu, who said, never write a letter and never destroy a letter. So maybe it's just deep-rooted cynicism. But whatever, it will be possible, I've no doubt, to be able to, regarding the night of the guarantee, to ask people, you know, what were the options open to you? And what was your thinking in choosing option A rather than option B? And there was enough preparatory work that had been done prior to that night in terms of working out the financial implications of the major options facing the government. And frankly, I would agree with Michael McGrath that of less interest to me, less than the night of the guarantee, is what led up to the night of the guarantee. Mm-hmm. Because I think that night the government really was almost out of options, and about the only action I think the government had open to it was to have a slightly reduced guarantee where junior subordinated government debt would not have been included. That's about it. And that wouldn't have saved a hill of beans either, even if they'd opted for that, as Governor Honohan subsequently suggested.
Are you interested in what happened after the night of the guarantee?
I am. I'm principally interested in what's happening now, because I think there's so much spilt milk. And if you, I teach finance in UCD and to Chartered Accountants Ireland, and I always focus very much on financial bubbles. And the history is nearly always the same. It's euphoria, mass participation on the way in. It's guilt, a search for scapegoats after the event. And my fear is it's going to be very hard for the people involved in this inquiry, however tightly the legal remit is defined and however much they try to contain themselves, not to fall into the trap of searching for scapegoats. And another aspect, misgiving I would have with what is proposed, is it seems to me that the primary focus of this inquiry will be on Irish stories, Irish witnesses, an Irish account, even though what is happening in Ireland is being matched across the periphery of the Eurozone. And we have then the big chief from Frankfurt, Mr. Trichet, giving us a two-fingered salute.
Mm-hmm. And we can hear that now.
It's quite unacceptable that somebody should be granted institutional independence and then refuse to give an accounting when a duly constituted inquiry is established.
Well, indeed. And we can hear from Mr. Trichet and another person who worked in Brussels for a very long time now, because as we've been talking about, there has been a debate whether or not Jean-Claude Trichet, who was governor of the ECB at the time, should be called before the forthcoming banking inquiry. Well, here he is on News Talk Radio last week being asked if he would appear before the inquiry.
I supported nothing. I observed the bank guarantee. It was not a decision which was it was taken by the Irish government absolutely alone, without any consultation, either with the central bank or with other countries.
Is that a fair response, Michael McGrath? Was a decision taken by the Irish government? It had nothing to do with the ECB.
Well, it may well be, and that is one of the facts that we will need to establish in the inquiry itself. But I think it is not acceptable that Mr. Draghi would immediately rule himself out of coming before an inquiry by the Irish Parliament, because he does have questions to answer in relation to the role of the ECB, particularly in the period after the guarantee, when the government sought to minimise the exposure to the Irish taxpayer in the lead up to the bailout, for example, in November 2010. We know for a fact that there is correspondence there, somewhat of a threatening nature, apparently, from the ECB to the late Brian Lenihan, which has never been released.
And last week, I think he said he still couldn't release it because it would destabilise matters even further.
Well, I believe that really it would make a mockery of the inquiry if documentation such as that is not provided, because if we are to identify, you know, why the losses ended up on the shoulders of the Irish people, yes, of course, you have to examine the guarantee, you have to examine the failure to impose losses on senior bondholders, the reasons why did not happen, for example. And we know that after the guarantee, the main reason why that did not happen, which Michael Noonan found out in 2011 when he sought to do the same thing, was that the ECB refused point blank. Now, I understand Mr. Trichet is saying, well, you know, the Irish Central Bank can represent the ECB at the inquiry. That's not the case. That simply isn't good enough. When I write to the current ECB president, Mario Draghi, about different issues, he responds to me directly. He doesn't pass on my letter to Patrick Honohan as governor of the Central Bank. So the European dimension has to form an important part of the inquiry, because the whole thing is integrated and interconnected. Examining the Irish situation in isolation, you know, it might satisfy a political narrative, but it's not going to represent a comprehensive statement of precisely what happened.
Well, Owen Murphy, you will have powers of compellability. Can you compel him to appear?
Well, I mean, it's important to state that he hasn't been invited yet, so he hasn't declined. No one's been asked to appear in front of this committee yet. And we as members will have to decide who will be on those lists, and then we'll invite them formally, and then they can decide what their positions is. So it's important, I think, to restate that. I mean, there are issues here that are particular to the Irish banking system, the Irish governance system and our political system, but there's also a European element, as Michael points out, and that will have to be looked at in due course. But we've got to be careful of mission creep. I mean, this cannot be an inquiry into the Irish financial system for 20 years or whatever we might decide. We have to look at the banking guarantee in terms of the couple of months immediately leading up to it, the night itself, and then some of the main decisions that came as a consequence of it in one phase. And that's identified in the scoping report done by the PAC subcommittee. And we then have to look at the role of the financial regulator, the central bank, the government, the Oireachtas itself as a body, and what its role was in trying to kind of hold the government of the day to account in terms of what was coming down the line. And we have to look at the banks and their external auditors. But again, it comes back to the importance of having a very tight terms of reference. So this inquiry, you know, happens in an efficient manner. We can't have this, as Michael said again earlier, going on forever.
But do you agree that the European dimension is absolutely critical to it?
I think it's absolutely a part of it, but to what extent we will decide, I suppose, when we meet as a committee and when we look at the different reports, we look at the gap analysis that's been done, we look at the phasing and we decide how we're going to approach it. But just to be fair to the person, he hasn't been formally asked.
Sure,
I think
no,
it was a question from a journalist.
Yeah, absolutely. We can hear from another person, as I said, who worked in Brussels for a long time. It's José Manuel Barroso's former advisor, Philippe Legrand. And he was on Irish radio. He was on RTE last week, actually, saying that Ireland had been bullied into accepting the bailout of the banks.
Obviously, it was a mistake by the previous government to guarantee all Irish bank debts. But it was outrageous to, in effect, threatened to force Ireland out of the euro unless the government went through with that foolish pledge. And the result of that has been an unjust debt burden of 64 billion euro. That's 14,000 euro for every man, woman and child in Ireland. It is outrageous that the ECB in particular, which is meant to be the central bank of all citizens that use the euro, threatened to deprive some of those citizens of the use of that currency. Well, I think the bullying came from Germany because German banks were exposed a lot to Ireland. It came from the European Commission, which aligned itself very closely with Germany and which had no experience whatsoever of dealing with financial or debt crisis and was completely out of its depth. And it came from the ECB, with Jean-Claude Trichet in particular, who sought to advance the interests of French banks above the interests of Eurozone citizens as a whole. I can understand why the Irish government was too afraid to face down the ECB. On the other hand, I think if it had, the ECB would have blinked, because, first of all, depriving Irish citizens of using the euro would have been seen as an abuse of power. But secondly, forcing Ireland out of the euro could have caused the euro to unravel and obviously the ECB to disappear. So I think if Ireland had stood up to the ECB would have backed down. Irish ministers should have said that it was unjust and unbearable for Irish taxpayers to bear in full the debts of Irish banks, but debts which were largely owned to foreign banks, which should logically have taken losses on their bad loans to bankrupt banks. And they should have said that it is the very opposite of solidarity to treat a so-called partner in this bullying an outrageous way, and to, you know, the currency is supposed to be a community of equals. It's meant to be an expression of our common Europeanness, and instead of that, it's been used as a lever for banks in certain countries to impose unjust conditions on taxpayers in another country, and that's just completely wrong.
That was former advisor to José Manuel Barroso, Philippe Legrand, on the News at One last week. Cormac, Lucy, do you think the ECB would have blinked had the Irish government stood up to them?
Possibly, but it's if you were Brian Cowan or if you were any Irish Taoiseach, it's a hell of a gamble to play chicken with the Irish economy at stake in a game of bluff with people sitting in Frankfurt who, frankly, we still barely know their names. So the degree of opprobrium they would have borne if they'd got it wrong would be quite small, the personal cost they would pay, whereas the personal cost you would pay if you got it wrong would be quite large. And I had to smirk when Philippe Legrand referred to the EU as a community of equals. It was Charles de Gaulle who said that the European community, as then was, is France and Germany, the rest are just trimmings. And we have some Euro enthusiasts out there who need to get real about what we're involved in. And I think it's interesting that Philippe Legrand has opened up with his thinking today on what happened several years ago. The central bank recently gave information to the Sunday Independent that they had prepared plans for Ireland to leave the euro a number of years ago. And this week, the Financial Times has revealed that Frau Merkel broke down in tears at a G8 summit when she felt Germany was being asked to take on too much of a burden and that she was effectively being asked to commit political suicide. So what we're seeing with all of these stories is that behind the scenes, the unity of Europe is far, far more fragile than we're being led to believe. And that's why I suggest we should leave the euro. And that's what I've said in my recent book, Plan B, because I do think it's going to come to that eventually. And we need to think in those terms and prepare for that eventuality.
And your book's available in all good bookshops.
That's right.
Michael, what's your view on Philippe Legrand's comments? Do you think the ECB would have blinked?
I mean, that is an impossible question to answer. It really is anybody's guess as to whether or not they would have regarded Ireland as being dispensable back in 2010, when certainly they did want Ireland to enter into a bailout at that time. And, you know, it's quite clear that they refused the government's efforts then to impose losses on bondholders. I think the ECB's attitude at the time was that, look, let's contain this crisis now, let's deal with Ireland, and that will solve the euro crisis. And of course, that assessment was fundamentally flawed, and that was proven to be so over the subsequent years, when of course the crisis widened and deepened throughout the eurozone. But if you go back to, you know, what happened here, okay, the liabilities of the banks were guaranteed. The figure that is put out there is a figure of 64 billion euro as being the cost of that. When you take into account the sale of certain bank shares, the sale of Irish Life, the guarantee fees that have come in, the valuation of the state shareholding in the banks today, you have a net cost of somewhere over 40 billion euro, still absolutely enormous. But you have to question, you know, the efforts that were made to reduce that bill even further. Why were those efforts stymied? Because the guarantee of September 2008 was a time-limited guarantee. Billions of euro of bank senior bonds came out of guarantee in September, October 2010. And the efforts were made then to minimise the exposure of the Irish taxpayers, to impose losses on those senior bondholders who took risks, who made investments. Let's bear in mind that the shareholders in the banks, including many ordinary Irish people and pension funds, lost everything. They lost about 30 billion euro in share value when the banks collapsed. And yet a European body, the ECB, insisted that these bondholders would take no pain whatsoever. The new government came in, said that they were going to revisit that issue, seek to impose losses, and again were rebuffed. Now, to me, that has to be an important part of the inquiry to establish exactly what happened. And we do need to see the documentation. And I don't, for a moment, accept the notion that this in some way risks financial stability, that a letter which everybody knows is out there, going back to November 2010, would be redacted or kept from a committee in Ireland conducting a democratic inquiry.
Owen Murphy.
You know, I think after the guarantee is a key question that the inquiry will have to look at. You know, the different decisions that followed on from it, recapitalisation of the banks, the setting up of NAMA, the nationalisation of Anglo. But there is a question again as to how far you go. I mean, do you go as far then as the bailout? You know, and then again, you're looking again at like time for the committee, terms of reference and those kinds of issues. So we need to look at that carefully in terms of getting the answers. But in relation to getting the papers that we need and different records, once this inquiry goes through, it's what we'll do is we'll set up the terms of reference and what we think the phasing will be. We'll then apply to the Committee on Procedures and Privileges in the DAW, which will be a sort of a mini oversight committee for the banking inquiry, to go ahead and to move into an investigative mode. And once we do that, we have the power then to request papers and documentation. If there's documents there held by government departments, they should, of course, be given over to the inquiry team.
David, my point, Owen, there really is that, you know, we have to follow through on the workout of the banking losses. Like, if you allow banks to build up the kind of exposures that they were allowed to build up, there was always going to be a cost to the state and a cost to taxpayers. I think that's an absolute given. But those losses were there, and then you have to follow through, you know, the policy decisions that were made through the guarantee, the impact of that, then the ending of the guarantee, what happened to those losses that were in the system, the workout of those over time, including the fact that senior bondholders were insisted upon to be repaid in full. I think that is a natural flow of the inquiry, examining the losses and then where they ended up and why they ended up there.
David Duffy.
For me, we had the car crash in 2008, and we have to look at what happened up to the car crash and after the car crash. Up to the car crash, I think, needs fundamental examinations, has some of that in the other reports. So I would be interested in finding out, you know, whether, and this is to use an expression used last weekend by Leo Bradker, were all our various institutions fit for purpose or not? But more importantly, while you can have the best processes and procedures in the world, if we don't have the right talent around them and the right skills, they can still fail. So our government departments have not been great at actually bringing in good technical skills, whether it's health economists or accountants or whatever. Unlike the French civil service, where to advance within that, you actually must have good technical skills. We've just finished the review of a particular government department, and our French colleagues were stunned at the fact of the lack of technical competence to be able to advance in a government department. So if you go back to 2003, 2004, 2005, I mean, who was looking at the radar screen and what skill set was being applied to it? Because the signs were there.
Who should have been looking?
Well, I would have thought the Department of Finance had a role, the Central Bank had a role, and those are the two main parties. But who was looking at that? And there were commentators out there that were kind of raising red flags that were kind of poo-pooed and should have been paid a lot more attention to. So some of that's already come out in some of the current reports. But I think for me, you know, the real test of any process or any procedure is what happens in a crisis. And we did have that crisis. And what skills around the table on that night that took those decisions? Now, if they had external advisors, were they good enough? But should we have had advisors within the camp who could say, well, that's great advice, Michael, I'm going to park it because I think we can do something different that might be better for the country. So that comes down to, I suppose, the horsepower that we need within government departments, within the central bank, within the Department of Finance. I'm not sure we had it then.
Mm. And Chris Johns, writing in the Irish Times last week, David, was saying that, you know, okay, people involved in this inquiry, they may need an understanding of banking, but in his view, they need a deep understanding of organisational psychology when it comes to what goes on in corporate meetings like that.
Yeah, well, if you take the banks, you know, and there are some really good people involved in these boards, but at the end of the day, there was a herd mentality, you know, to satisfy the market. And that, I mean, banking is a very simple business. You know, you buy money at a certain price from depositors and you lend it to lenders, and there's a margin in between which pays your overheads and produces a profit margin. There were some great minds around those tables who just forgot that basic principle. You should never lend to people where you don't think you're going to get it back from. So either you lend too much to an individual or individuals, as happened in one particular bank, or you lend too much into a sector. Somebody was asleep on the watch.
I think there's a moral dimension to this. You know, if you read the central bank reports, they were issuing warnings in the late 90s. Then they went quiet. And it is telling that Honohan Report didn't pick this up. Regling didn't pick it up. Wright didn't pick it up. They were willing to be represented as not having foreseen this in preference to revealing that they had foreseen it and then pull their warnings as those warnings raise questions about their own credibility. I also think it's interesting that in Honohan's report, he criticised the boards of commercial banks, but failed to criticise the board of the central bank, which had legislative responsibility for system stability. So, you know, if you had been a bank managing director in 2004, and if you had said to your board, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're in a bubble, we're going to contain lending. A year later, your bankers would have had lower bonuses, your competitors would have taken market share, and your chairman would have felt embarrassment. And you might have sustained that for another 6 months, you know, with plenty of comments, we stand four square behind our chief executive along the way, and you'd have been dumped and replaced by somebody who was much more aggressive. And it was the central bank's job. They were the ones insulated, firewalled from political accountability or pressure, and they completely failed to act. And I thought it was rather odd that Governor Honohan, when writing his report, would fail to note that the board of the central bank had any responsibility at all. And I'd like to see those people questioned about what they were thinking and what they were doing.
David.
If you look at IPSRA, which was set up some time ago and was a compromise and probably failed as a compromise.
What's that now?
IPSRA.
Oh, the Irish Financial Services Regulatory Authority.
Yeah, okay. And the central bank. If you look at the profile of those board members, I don't think there was anybody who actually understood global systemic risk and the consequences of something happening at a macro level in an economy. And I'm open to correction on that, but I don't think there was. For me, that's a fundamental kind of skill gap that you should have at central bank level, which I don't think is there. It probably is there now because we have a new governor and he's from outside the country. So if you're looking at skill gaps, that was a fundamental one. There is the thing that Cormac has raised, which is kind of allied to it, kind of ethics and values. You can still have the best process and procedures in the world, but the tone from the top of the organisation, whether it's politically or from the central bank, or indeed from some of the commercial organisations, was not the appropriate one. They were seeing, you know, profit. The central bank was probably seeing the economy is growing, it's good for everybody, seeing jobs. But there was nobody there with that kind of moral compass that I think is required in a situation like this. And I think that's not there today. If you look at the failings in the church, you look at the guards and some aspects of the state. And I think that's something that actually Michael D. Higgins is actually coming back to in the autumn.
Mm-hmm. Owen Murphy.
Well, just to say, I mean, in terms of some of the deficiencies that might be there in the central bank or the department, I mean, the Wright report identified about 50 recommendations to fill some of those skills gaps. And I believe some of that work has been done. But when we talk about boards and the people on these boards, the Anglo trial was actually quite interesting in that regard in terms of the roles and responsibilities of board members. I mean, you know, if they sought legal advice from outside, was it enough to simply accept that or did they have to question it themselves? You know, why were they seeking legal advice? And then also, you know, because the regulator was aware or to the degree that they were aware, did that excuse the board of culpability or responsibility and things that then followed on from that? And it's something I think that we as a society have had to look at properly since the financial crisis, this kind of cultural failing of our boards and people not being aware of their actual responsibilities on these boards and what that has meant then for, I mean, there's actually, for a lot of organisations, it's difficult to get members to serve now on boards because of this awareness now of what is actually involved and the liability that might fall onto someone for their action on a board or their failure to act, as might be the case. So that's another thing that's come out of this. I think it's something that needs to be looked at as well in terms of understanding the mentality of the time.
John Murphy has a question for you, David. Should each state institution be subject to a fit for purpose or a governance check on a regular basis?
Well, I think it's worrying this, what's happened in the Department of Justice of late. You know, is that a one-off or is it systemic? I probably think it isn't, but I think on a regular basis there should be some sort of, you know, fit for purpose check of key government departments, indeed all government departments.
How would you do that, though? You know, it only becomes an issue when something goes wrong.
And who would do it? Who is qualified to do that?
Well, I think that could be worked out as to who would do it. It shouldn't be anybody close to it. It should be probably something independent from overseas who has no axe to grind. But as a principle, I think we can work out the detail. I think it should happen on a regular basis. For instance, there's a new code out recently called SWIFT, which is the country's response to a quality assurance mark for corporate governance. It's like ISO 9000. Which was launched by Richard Root a number of years ago. Now, it hasn't gone very far, but that's kind of a benchmark you could use. It's not perfect, but it could be used for government department.
Could I just, I mean, I worked in the Department of Justice under Michael McDougall for several years, and I find it interesting that people are now saying the department is not fit for purpose. It's certainly clear that the reforms we pushed through didn't go nearly far enough, particularly in relation to the Garda Síochána. But one thing I found in the Department of Justice was that if the minister made a decision, that decision was implemented. And I think we're in danger of having two principles and cross purposes here. One is the notion of managerial autonomy and efficiency. And the other is ministers being in constitutional charge of their departments. And I think if you have a poor minister who makes poor judgments, you need to be careful about then blaming the people, the civil servants underneath, for somehow being co-responsible for that decision.
When is that really what Alan Shatter has done, do you think? Or?
Well, I think he made a lot of very poor decisions.
I know we're getting off topic, but yeah. No, but that is interesting. And I suppose I wanted to bring in the Guardian. I know some of you have already, because Michael McGrath, I suppose, are we complacent now when it comes to the banks? Everyone is saying we know now how to stop the banks from misbehaving. And I'm just wondering, back in the 90s with the Morris Tribunal and everything then that was put in place to achieve a better and more efficient and accountable Garda Síochána, everyone thought it was going to work all right. And now it's been shown that it's not working okay. And I'm just wondering, could the same happen in the banking sector?
I think it could. I think we are being complacent. And I agree with Cormac when he highlighted the issue of mortgage arrears, for example. I have sat through a plethora of Oireachtas Finance Committee hearings at this stage, where we have brought the banks before us and we have quizzed them pretty forensically about their approach to dealing with mortgage arrears. And quite frankly, there are some fundamental questions that need to be asked about what they are doing, what they are being allowed to do, the lack of proper and detailed oversight by the central bank in the management of the mortgage arrears crisis. And to me, that is a crisis which is in the here and now. That is a crisis that people are going to bed tonight worrying, are they going to lose their home in 2014? And that is the reality. And I'm sure Owen is meeting those people. I am meeting those people in my constituency office every single week. So I think that David made an excellent point about the herd mentality, and that is referred to in the reports that have been conducted so far into the banking crisis. All of the banks saw what Anglo-Irish Bank was doing and they said, we want to have a bit of that as well. You know, huge dividends being paid, share price rising and rising, the executives on enormous pay packets, and it seemed to be, you know, a win-win situation. And you really have to ask the question as to why the banks in Ireland departed from the traditional model of banking, taking in deposits, lending out money, charging more interest on the loans out than you pay to the depositors. Why they moved to a situation where you had, okay, an intrabank market with very cheap borrowing available. They took that money, short-term money on the cheap, and lent it out long-term into one sector, the property sector. And they all followed headfirst into the Anglo-Irish bank model. And that, you know, it's very evident from the reports that we have so far that was a key issue. And we have to ask, why did that happen? You know, what decisions were being made by the credit committees? What kind of a assessment of risk was being done in terms of the financial stability of those banks, what kind of sensitivity analysis was being done, that if property prices dropped by 20%, we know they ended up dropping by 50 to 60%, what impact would that have had on the balance sheets of the banks? And then, of course, the oversight of those banks, which was the role of the financial regulator, central bank, then on the wider macroeconomic and financial stability of the economy. Those are fundamental questions that still remain unanswered. Mm. And if we can achieve anything in this inquiry, it is to hold people accountable in a public way and for the purpose of history, if nothing else, that all of this would be properly recorded, the right questions would be asked, and people, even if they won't give the right answer, would be given an opportunity to do so.
And you won't shy away from asking Brian Cowan the hard questions, will you?
Absolutely would not shy away from asking Brian Cowan, Bertie Ahern, Patrick Neary, David Drum, if he comes back and participates in the inquiry, all of the people who are involved, both within the banks, at a policy level, the auditors also need to be involved, the ECB, and indeed the professional advisors who were involved in the decisions which were made at the time. My approach will be without fear or favour, and it will be to follow the evidence and ask robust, hard but fair questions of those who had some role to play in the whole thing.
Owen Murphy, will Enda Kenny be on the list of invitees to appear before the committee? Because there was email contacts between him and Anglo when he was Fine Gael leader at the time.
I mean, that's impossible to say because we have to look at the details of what's before us as a committee, terms of reference, again, the modules, like I said before, who'd appear in various modules and why they'd appear. But just to come back, I mean, to your question about, you know, has anything changed with the banks or, you know, will we make the same mistakes? One thing that I think, and people have noticed this, is, again, the role of the Oireachtas in all of this. I mean, you look at the Finance Committee, I don't sit on it, but, you know, I wonder how many thousands of people saw Stephen Donnelly questioning Richie Boucher. I mean, whereas before, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that wouldn't have happened at all. So I think as people have demanded more from their politicians, I think it's one aspect in the Oireachtas where one of the committees can hold their heads up high is that they've been paying a hell of a lot of attention to the banks. They've been bringing them in on a regular basis, asking them the difficult questions, and long may that continue. And again, and Michael alluded to it earlier, it falls to the banking inquiry too to prove to the people the worth of its political institutions and the people who fill those institutions that they can handle these big and difficult tasks that are asked of them. I mean, rarely in this case because of the scale of the crisis, but it's important that we rise to that challenge. And again, I mean, just to come back to the point, because we'll have to come back to it, I think, a number of times, is to manage people's expectations to what this can achieve at the end of the day. Inquire, record, report, fill the gaps in our knowledge, hold people to account publicly, and then learn as best we can for the future to mitigate against future risks and future problems.
Cormac, what's your view on that question of whether or not people, many of us, are too complacent at the moment? Many of us think this could never happen again, given the catastrophe that did happen.
I think the human species tends to complacency. So, I mean, one issue that is never faced is unfunded pension liabilities that the state owes. And KPMG did a report for Joan Burton last year. They reckon unfunded PRSI liabilities, $324 billion. The Controller and Auditor General, in his most recent report, estimated the public sector pension liability, $98 billion. So there's $400 billion plus. That's an iceberg. We can just see the tip of it above the water. That's in front of us. And we have our eyes to the rear of the ship at this banking crisis. Now, I don't mean to belittle the banking crisis or the distress it caused and still causes, but I think there is a tendency in democratic politics to point to voters to the nice things that democracy produces and to soft soap and downplay the costs. And there are some significant bills that will be coming in the decades to come. And we need to keep our eyes on them and make sure we're not overwhelmed by them.
Fair point, Michael.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is very much a fair point. And but the decision has been made that this inquiry is going to be held. It is going to be backward looking. And I think it is important that we do fill the gaps in terms of knowledge. The reports that have been conducted so far, the hearings were in private. The Nyberg report in particular did conduct a lot of interviews. Many of the people who will be invited before the Oireachtas banking inquiry have already given testimony to Peter Nyberg, but in a public manner. And I think that has not satisfied the public appetite for all of this to play out in a public forum. I think we do owe that to people because, you know, the banking crisis was not the only crisis we had, but certainly the reduction in living standards that people have experienced in the last 5 or 6 years, the tax increases that everybody is paying, the reduction in public services, you know, it can, to a greater or lesser extent, be traced back to the banking crisis. There is a direct connection. So I think we owe it to people to do this work professionally, comprehensively, and to bring the key people before us.
But Owen, you can't bury your heads in the sand about what's coming down the line either.
No, we can't. But I mean, again, the banking inquiry will have 9 members from the Oireachtas, 7 TDs and 2 senators. I mean, the Public Accounts Committee will be taking up the pensions issue very soon on the back of the CNAG's work. And I think Cormac's absolutely right to point to it. If there hadn't have been the banking crisis that we had, that would be the crisis we'd all be talking about today. And we should be. And that work will be done, hopefully, okay, in the near future.
Well, look, thank you all very much indeed for joining us tonight. Michael McGrath, Owen Murphy, David Duffy and Cormac Lucy. We'll be discussing our relationship with Europe on the programme tomorrow night in advance of the European elections next week. So join us for that if you can, the usual time, 10 o'clock. Until then, from me and from all the team, good night.
The Late Debate, presented by Ordy Carvel, was produced by Donal O'Herlihy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher is Richie Byrne. And sound supervision tonight was by Patrick Carney.